Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We are in module number 11, going through the book of Revelation. This is lesson number 40. Now, last week, I started a two-part, I'm hoping to keep it to two parts, introduction to Mystery Babylon, the destruction of Mystery Babylon, that's expanded on. It's actually mentioned first in Revelation chapter 14 when it places the timing of the destruction of Babylon, that is, Babylon has fallen. It places that at the midpoint of the tribulation. But in chapters 18, 17 and 18 and the beginning of 19, we have an expansion, sort of like going back and giving a really detailed explanation of what was meant by that statement, Babylon has fallen, in chapter 14. All right, so last week we talked a lot about this concept of Israel having a marriage covenant with God, with his son, actually, technically, if you really understand the Godhead properly, and how that he divorced her because of her fornication, her idolatry, and so forth. And we talked a little bit about Babylon in the Old Testament that God used as his to bring his judgment upon Israel. Now, I spent a lot of time last time talking about how we are to understand the symbols in the book of Revelation. The fact that many people make the mistake of thinking that just because a passage in Revelation references an Old Testament passage, they make the mistake of thinking that that Old Testament passage is prophesying about the end times, when in fact, traditionally, what Revelation does, and it does borrow from some passages that are talking about the end times, but traditionally what it does is it borrows from prophecy that has already been fulfilled in the Old Testament, and then it uses that as a its fulfillment and how it was fulfilled. It uses that as a if you will, for how we are to understand the same symbols being used in Revelation with regard to the end times. All right, so it basically what it does is it gives us a sort of a dictionary on how to define the symbols that are found in the book of Revelation. Okay, now I mentioned last time briefly, but I want to drive this point home, okay, in case some of you didn't get it. But there in the Bible, there are in the Old Testament, there are two major judgments upon Israel. The law of Moses gave certain conditions for Israel to be able to reside in the land. In fact, God told them that they were tenants in the land. The point of that statement was that they did not receive the permanent inheritance of the land under the old covenant. And when God gave the blessings and the cursings for Israel, if they would keep his law or if they would not keep his law, excuse me a second here. He gave the very worst judgment that he would bring upon Israel, and that was he would drive them out of the land and he would destroy his house, completely, utterly destroy his house. Well, that happened, all of you know, that happened in during the Babylonian exile. After the period of the kings, after Solomon, God brought Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians down, and he used them as his tool to destroy his own house, destroy the city of Jerusalem, to utterly destroy the temple, and then to take Israel or Judah off as captives to Babylon for 70 years. And then at the end of that 70-year period, you know, Jeremiah prophesied that that period would last 70 years. Then he brought Cyrus down to conquer the Babylonians, and Cyrus was very benevolent with regard to the Jews who were captives in Babylon, and he was shown the prophecy of Isaiah, the prophet, and which talks about him by name and what he would do as far as restoring Jerusalem and restoring the temple. And so Cyrus granted the Jews that were under Babylonian rule formerly, he sort of absorbed them into the Persian Empire, but he granted them permission to go back and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and to begin their worship of God again. And so that ended the first exile. However, the scripture talks a lot about a second exile in the Old Testament. And there was going to be a second exile from the land, a second destruction of Jerusalem, and this period would last much longer excuse me, than the 70-year exile. All right, so my point is that the Old Testament predicts two destructions of Jerusalem, two separate destructions of Jerusalem, followed by two separate exiles, followed by two separate restorations to the land. All right, the first was the destruction under Nebuchadnezzar, the exile in Babylon for 70 years, followed by the restoration to the land by God's anointed one. He calls him his anointed one, Cyrus. And Cyrus, that whole scenario establishes a pattern for how the second exile of Israel is going to end. Now, the second exile of Israel was by the Romans, and the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. They drove the Jews into exile. They maintained power over the Jews. They drove them out of the land of Israel, but they remained within the Roman Empire, and so they were sort of in exile in the Roman Empire under Rome, and they have been in exile under Rome all the way up until the present day. Now, I'm not going to talk about 1948 and the Jews returning to the Holy Land and all that right now, okay? But just keep this in mind, that from a prophetic point of view, the restoration of Israel to the land is something that God does by his divine intervention. It's not what the UN does. Okay, God is going to restore the remnant of Israel back to the land, that he's going to do it supernaturally, and he's going to do it when Jesus Christ returns. Okay, and there are many prophecies in the Old Testament about that. In fact, Isaiah talks about them being restored to the land a second time, that they will inherit the land a second time. He uses that exact language. All right, so there's two judgments of Israel, and one is a pattern for the other. And this is where Revelation comes in, because what Revelation does is it draws imagery from the prophecies about Jerusalem and about its first exile, its first destruction of the temple, its first exile, and its first restoration back to the land. It uses that as sort of a parallel. It uses the symbols that the prophets in the Old Testament used to predict the first exile. It uses the same symbols to talk about the end of the second exile. And the reason it does that is because we have now, us living in the end times, we have history to define those symbols. See, we see how those prophecies were fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar and then eventually by Cyrus. We see how Jeremiah's and Ezekiel's and Isaiah's prophecies were fulfilled. So the symbols in those prophecies, now we have a clear meaning for what they mean, because we're not guessing anymore. We don't have to guess about what these symbols mean. We see how they were fulfilled in Israel's first exile. And so now we can take that meaning and give it to the same symbols that are used with regard to Israel's second exile, the time of Israel's second exile, okay? Now, and restoration to the land that Revelation uses, okay? Now, before I move on, I just want to say this by way of anticipating some future lessons, since I'm on this subject of two judgments and one being a mirror image of the other, we have exactly the same thing happening with regard to what is referred to as the defiling of the temple. All right, there are two destructions of the temple followed by exile, and those were judgments upon Israel, where God just absolutely poured out his wrath upon Israel. Well, there are two, what I would call, testings of Israel, where God allowed a pagan king to come in and to decimate and defile his temple in order to test his people, the leadership of his people, to see if they would endure and if they would stick with God's commandments, even under severe persecution. All right, now he did that the first time. He allowed Antiochus Epiphanes around 165 BC to come in, and as a Syrian king, he came in, he placed his image in the temple, he committed what Daniel calls the abomination of desolation. He uses that exact phrase. All right, so there's two abominations of desolation. There was one under Antiochus Epiphanes around 165 BC. And then there is an abomination of desolation in the end times. And the one is a mirror image of the other. Okay? So how do we know what's going to happen in the temple? How do we know what's going to happen with regard to persecution? How are we going to know how this end time tribulation is going to play out? All we have to do is go back and look at Antiochus Epiphanes, what he did, how he persecuted God's people, how God's people overcame the Antichrist, and how they did so by the power of God. All right, now this is meant to be that pattern is meant to be a example for us, so we know how to behave and what we know what God is going to do in the end times, both with regard to the abomination of desolation and the persecution that follows that from the midpoint to the end of the tribulation. We know how to react to that because we look back in history and see we have a pattern for that. And the same is true with regard to the first and second exiles from the land. Now, the first exile from the land, again, was by Babylon. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple and took them as captives to Babylon. Cyrus, God's anointed, he calls him his anointed on purpose because he is a mirror image of the anointed one in Revelation who is coming back, and he is going to restore Israel to the land permanently, and that's Jesus Christ. All right, so I want you to understand that when we're talking about exile, we have two exiles. When we're talking about abomination of desolations, we have two. All right, the history informs us on how and what is going to happen in the end times. It interprets the symbols for us. And so, you know, we celebrate Hanukkah. Our assemblies, our local assemblies celebrate Hanukkah. Why do we celebrate Hanukkah? Well, Hanukkah tells the story of the first defiling of the temple by Antiochus, which again is a mirror image of what's going to happen in the end times with the Antichrist, and then the ultimate restoration of Christ's kingdom on the earth when he establishes his temple, when Christ sits on his throne in his temple and reigns in Jerusalem. And then the 8 days of celebration is the 8 days of dedication of the first temple, which is a mirror image of what Christ is going to do in the kingdom. Okay, so I want to be sure that you understand those things, because they're critically important to interpreting the book of Revelation. And I have to tell you that most interpreters of Revelation have missed that point. And so what they do is they make the mistake of thinking that because Revelation references Old Testament prophecy, that those Old Testament prophecies are speaking about the end times. And some of them are, but many of them are not. And when we talk about Mystery Babylon, it's not. It's not talking. The Old Testament is not prophesying about the end times with regard to that. It's prophesying about Babylon in Jeremiah's day and Daniel and Ezekiel's day. Okay, all right, so having said all that, I want you to go to Jeremiah chapter 11. And I want to show you that there are always two players with regard to the exile of Israel. Okay, let's go back to Jeremiah chapter 11. And I want to show you that there are two judgments going on with regard to these two. Revelation chapter 11. And hold on, my pages are sticking. Okay. We're going to read verses 16 and 17. Remember, Jeremiah prophesied for the 40-year period that ended with Nebuchadnezzar destroying the temple. And Jeremiah's entire prophecy, he does prophesy some things in the distant future, but for the most part, his prophecy concerns this coming destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. All right, so in verse 16, he says, he's talking about Israel, and he's prophesying. What he's going to do is he's going to tell Israel why God is sending Nebuchadnezzar to destroy Jerusalem and destroy his temple. Okay, and this is before he did it. The Lord called your name, green olive tree, lovely and of good fruit. With the noise of a great tumult, he has kindled fire on it, and its branches are broken. For the Lord of hosts, who planted you, has pronounced doom against you for the evil of the house of Israel and the house of Judah, which they have done against themselves to provoke me to anger in offering incense to Baal. Now the Lord gave me knowledge of it, and I know it, for you showed me their doings. That is, God showed Jeremiah the perversion of Israel and why he was doing this. Now, what I want you to notice from this passage first is that this is the passage that Paul is referencing in Romans 11 when he talks about Israel as an, or not just Israel, but the seed of Abraham as an olive tree, and that some of the branches are broken off. Now, when Paul uses it, what he's doing the same thing Revelation does. Okay, this here, this prophecy in Jeremiah is about the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon, and some of the branches are broken off, excuse me, and the tree is being burned. But in when Paul quotes from this passage, he's applying it to Jerusalem and Israel at the time of Christ and after the time of Christ, when God has decided to cut off Israel that rejects his son, and then shortly after that he sent the Romans in to do exactly the same thing as what Nebuchadnezzar did, and that is they utterly destroyed the temple of God, and they broke down the city of Jerusalem, and they excuse me, they cast the Jews out of the promised land, and they kept them as exiles under the Roman Empire in other lands. Okay, same thing Babylon did, exactly the same thing. It's a mirror image of it. Okay, again, Paul is not saying that I'm not saying, and Paul was not intending that Jeremiah was prophesying about the second destruction. What I'm showing you is Jeremiah prophesied about the first destruction. Paul borrows that exact imagery from Jeremiah, and he applies it to what was happening in his day and what was about to happen in his day, which Jesus prophesied when he said not one stone will be left upon another, you know, that would all be thrown down and all that stuff when he was talking about the temple there. All right, now, back to Jeremiah. When Jeremiah is shown these things by God and he's explaining to the nation of Israel why God is sending Nebuchadnezzar, who is going to destroy the temple in Jerusalem and take them off as captives, Jeremiah is a little bit incensed at God. And the reason he's incensed at God is because God is using a nation that is just as vile and just as pagan as Jerusalem had become, the Babylonians. So why is he allowing the Babylonians to continue in all their great splendor while and then allow them, or actually use them as his battle axe, and I'm going to show you that Jeremiah actually uses that term, that God uses Jerusalem as his Babylon as his battle axe. He's using them to judge his people when they are just as vile and wicked as his people. So how is that just? And so the justice of that kind of escaped Jeremiah. And so if you go to chapter 12, the very next chapter, just a few verses down, Jeremiah begins to respond to God after he showed him these things. He says, "Righteous are you, O Lord, when I plead with you, yet let me talk with you about your judgments." That is, let me plead and reason with you about the way you're judging Israel. He says, "Why does the way of the wicked prosper?" And that is, he's talking about Babylon. "Why are those happy who deal so treacherously?" That is, by coming in and destroying Jerusalem. "You have planted them. Yes, they have taken root." Now notice, he's contrasting the fact that God planted his prime olive tree, which was the seed of Abraham and their descendants, their physical descendants, that God planted them as his choice olive tree. But now Jeremiah is talking about Babylon and these other armies that are coming down to destroy Jerusalem. He's saying, wait a minute, you also planted them. Okay, so they didn't just pop up on their own, right? They're of God's hands also. I mean, God created them. He says, "You planted them. Yes, they have taken root. They grow. Yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. But you, O Lord, know me. You have seen me, and you have tested my heart towards you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter, and prepare them for the day of slaughter." And then he goes on to say, how long will the land mourn? That is, when they come and destroy Jerusalem, how long is this going to happen? And then later God shows him it's going to be 70 years. All right, now, the importance of this passage, you know, as I said, Paul borrows from this passage. Paul talks about the olive tree that God planted, which was Abraham and his descendants, and the covenant that he made with Abraham, and then he contrasts that with the wild olive tree. So what Paul does, he takes the main components of this allegory here, right? The prime olive tree is the descendants of Abraham and the covenant, who they held his covenant until they rejected Christ, and the fact that there are wild olive trees, which God also planted, which are, you know, were the Babylonians and all the other pagan nations, right? And so what Paul does is he borrows that. He talks about the wild olive trees, also Romans 11, being the Gentiles. Same components that you find here in Jeremiah. And then he talks about how that, you know, some of the branches of God's olive tree were broken off, but then branches from the wild olive tree, that is, the nations, he grafts into his own olive tree, and they become one with the olive tree, right? And then he tells them, do not boast against the branches, for, you know, you're dependent upon the root, right? And he says, if God did not spare them, he's not going to spare you also. And he's talking about how, and he's talking about in his day, Paul's day, and how God is cutting off those Jews who rejected his son from the olive tree. But the important point I want to show you is that shortly after this, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and completely obliterated the temple. And Paul had that in mind, knowing that Jesus had prophesied that also, okay? So I want you to be clear on that parallel. Now, the point I want to make here is that when we get to Jeremiah, actually go to Jeremiah chapter 50, okay? Jeremiah 50. Jeremiah 50 gives us the answer, 50 and 51, two chapters, gives us the answer to Jeremiah about, you don't need to worry, Jeremiah. Why, you know, Jeremiah is asking, why are you destroying, using a nation that's just as wicked as Israel to judge Israel? And God's answer to Jeremiah is, don't worry, Babylon's day is coming soon. Okay? My wrath is going to be poured out upon Babylon. And what God did to pour out his wrath upon Babylon was to rise up another nation, and that was Cyrus and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians, but Cyrus was the emperor at the time. Okay? And so he overthrew Babylon. Well, Jeremiah 50 and 51 is God's vision or statement to Jeremiah, his prophecy through Jeremiah about the judgment of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon by Cyrus when the Persian armies would come in and overthrow the Babylonians, and then Cyrus would allow the Jews to return back. So Cyrus was going to end the first exile that lasted 70 years. Now, you can read that. Please, maybe after this lesson is over, sit down and read all the way through Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51. I'm not going to take the time to do that. I only have a short time left to finish my lesson, so I'm not going to do that. But here's what I want to do. What I want to show you is that the imagery in Revelation 17 and 18 with regard to what is referred to as Mystery Babylon. It's called Babylon in chapter 14, and also in chapter 16. But in chapters 17 and 18, when he's giving a fuller description of it, he calls it Mystery Babylon. Why is it called Mystery Babylon? Because this is a riddle. All right. In order to figure out the riddle, you have to know the Old Testament prophecy, and you have to know how it was fulfilled. Then you can figure out Mystery Babylon in Revelation chapter 17 and 18. Okay? All right, so what I want to show you now is I'm going to draw a bunch of parallels. What I'm going to show you is that many of the symbols, in fact, the majority of the symbols used of Mystery Babylon are drawn out of Jeremiah 50 and 51. And they're drawn out of there because God wants us to look at Jeremiah 50 and 51 and how that was fulfilled when Cyrus destroyed the Babylonians, overthrew the Babylonians, that is the pattern for how we are to interpret Mystery Babylon in the end times. Okay, so let's look at these elements one by one. Go to Jeremiah 50, verses 1 and 2. The first thing I want to do is establish for you that Jeremiah 50 and 51, it's all one prophecy, that this is indeed about the historic Babylon that destroyed Jerusalem and the judgment that God was going to pour out against them in order to answer Jeremiah's pleading with God about his judgment, saying, you know, it's not fair that you use a pagan nation to judge your nation because they're pagan. All right? He figures that God should use a righteous nation. Well, there were no righteous nations. Okay? All right, look at Jeremiah 50, verse 1. It says, "The word of the Lord spoke against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans." Now, if you have any doubt that this is ancient Babylon, he calls it the land of the Chaldeans, and that's a term that's only used exclusively in the Bible with reference to the ancient kingdom of Babylon. So he says, "And against the land of the Chaldeans by Jeremiah the prophet." And now here is the prophecy. "Declare among the nations, proclaim and set up a standard, proclaim, do not conceal it. Say, Babylon is taken." Now, "Babylon is taken" is almost identical to the statement in Revelation, "Babylon is fallen." Okay? And then, "Bel is shamed. Merodach is broken in pieces. Her idols are humiliated. Her images are broken in pieces. For out of the north a nation comes against her, which shall make her land desolate." And now he's talking about the Medes and the Persians. Okay? So, it's very clear. And there's no question that this is historic Babylon. He even mentions the historic idols of Babylon. Bel was the well-known, most prominent god of the Babylonians. Okay, now, go to verse 13. You can read all of it. It talks about how they're plundered and all this stuff. But if you go down to verse 13, it says, "Because of the wrath of the Lord, she," that is Babylon, "shall not be inhabited, but she shall be wholly desolate. Everyone who goes by Babylon shall be horrified and hiss at her plagues." Now, this statement is referenced in Revelation chapter 18. Let's go there. Revelation 18, verse 2. I'm going to read from the Last Generation version. He says, He called with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great fell, and became the home of demons, and the cage for every unclean breath, and the cage for every filthy and detestable bird, because all the nations have drunk the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Okay, so we have that. Then we have, go skip down to verse 21. It says, and the mighty messenger picked up a boulder like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, with this kind of violence, Babylon, the great city, shall be thrown down and shall not be found, not anymore. And the sound of lyre singers and musicians and flutists and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore, nor any craftsman of any trade shall be found in you, not anymore, and so forth. Okay, so the point is that it's going to be desolate from that point on. Okay, so go down to Jeremiah, skip over to chapter 51. I'll show you another one of the statements that's borrowed from this section. Jeremiah 51 verse 6 says, flee from the midst of Babylon, and everyone save his life. Do not cut off in her iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He shall recompense her. Now, what's being said here in verse 6 is saying those who are followers of God, those who heed God's warning in Jeremiah's day, because the Persians were about to attack the city of Babylon, God's telling his people to flee out of the city before his judgment falls upon them by the Persians. Okay? So in this is the same exact thing is referenced in Revelation in chapter 18, verse 4. He says, and I heard another voice from the sky saying, flee from her, my people, so that you may not have fellowship with her sins, and so you may not receive her blows, because her sins have piled up to the sky, and and God has recalled her iniquities. Okay, so again, just before he's about to overthrow ancient Babylon, he tells his people to flee out of the city. Just before he is going to overthrow mystery Babylon, the city, he tells his people to flee out of that city, okay, which is Rome, and we'll prove that as we get further down into our lessons here. All right, now let's go to the next one. Go to Jeremiah 51:7, the very next verse. He says, Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand. Oh, the golden cup, huh? That made all the earth drunk, and the nations drank her wine. Therefore, the nations are deranged. Now, look at Revelation 17, verse 4. When John is seeing this woman riding the beast, which is Mystery Babylon, he says, verse 4, and the woman was dressed in purple and red, adorned with gold and valuable gems and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, being full of the abominations and filthinesses of her fornication. So, and she's drinking from the cup, and she's giving other nations to drink the wine. Okay? And they're becoming drunk. So, again, Babylon, ancient Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, is likened to a golden cup that is causing the other nations around it to drink and become drunk. Well, God's judgment fell on Babylon, but his judgment also spilled over on the whole Babylonian Empire. So all the other nations that were under her were also judged. Not like Babylon was, but they were also judged. Okay? So we see that as being drawn directly out of this passage. It's almost a direct quote. All right, now look at the next verse, verse 8. It says, Babylon has suddenly fallen. Oh, Babylon has fallen. Yeah, he's quoting that from Revelation 14, 8, Revelation 16, 19, Revelation 17, 16, and then Revelation 18, 2, 10, and 21. All of them talk about Babylon has fallen. Okay? Again, he's drawing it directly out of here. Next one is, go to Jeremiah 51, 13. He says, O you, again, referring to Babylon, O you who dwell by many waters. Okay, Babylon dwells by many waters. Well, look what it says here in Revelation chapter 17, verse 15, about Mystery Babylon. And he says to me, the waters which you saw where the prostitute is sitting, and again, this is in a metaphor or an allegory, are peoples and throngs and nations and languages. Okay, so he's interpreting that, but he's borrowing the same symbol here. All right, go to okay, now it's without a doubt, that Jeremiah 50 and 51, you should read both chapters later, are the prophecy of the destruction of ancient Babylon. And the reason for the destruction of ancient Babylon is because God used her to destroy and to judge his people and his temple and his city of Jerusalem and to send them into exile. Yet they are just as corrupt and just as pagan. And so in order for God to be just, God has got to pour out his wrath upon Babylon. But he's going to pour out his wrath upon ancient Babylon. He was going to pour his wrath upon ancient Babylon in a way that was more severe than the wrath that he poured out on Jerusalem using Babylon as his battle axe. All right. So now what you see in the prophecies of Jeremiah and Isaiah, who also prophesies the destruction of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, is that God uses language that refers to the permanent destruction of Babylon. However, when he talks about the wrath that he pours out upon Jerusalem, it's temporary because he has promised to receive her back to himself as his wife. Okay, he's divorcing her, but he's promised all through Isaiah, which was written before Jeremiah, he has promised to receive her back after he divorces her and he pummels her in the wilderness during this exile. He's promised to receive her back. Okay, so what we have in Jeremiah and in parts of Isaiah, parts of Ezekiel, parts of Daniel, what we see is this judgment upon two cities, upon Jerusalem and upon Babylon. He uses Babylon to punish Israel temporarily, and then he threatens and he has fulfilled his promises to utterly destroy Babylon, the kingdom of Babylon, or the city of Babylon and the kingdom of Babylon. All right, so this is the pattern for the end times, and this is what Revelation 17 is drawing from. Now, to show you, I just want to very briefly mention this fact, that the Old Testament and these same prophets prophesy a second exile, second destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and a second exile, and that God is going to restore Israel after a second exile, the second time, and it's at that time that he's going to fulfill his promises made to Abraham to give his people, the children of Abraham, the land that he promised as a permanent inheritance, and they'll never again be driven from the land. Okay, that this, there is this second exile. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you one passage, quick passage from the Old Testament, one passage from the New Testament that's talking about the very same thing. Okay, and then I'm going to give you a list of Old Testament verses. So get your pen ready. You need to write these down because later I want you to look them up and read them. But these Old Testament prophecies that I'm going to give you in a moment, the references, they are about the second exile and the end of the second exile. Okay, so let's go, first of all, to show you the prophecy of the second destruction of the temple, which was by the Romans in AD 70. And the exile that followed. Go to Daniel chapter 9. Excuse me. And let's read from verse 26. Well, actually, let's go back to verse 24. 70 weeks are determined for your people, for your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, and that was the command of Cyrus, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and or plus 62 weeks. Now the reason he divides that, that's a total of 69 weeks, and those weeks are sabbatical weeks. They're periods of 7 years where they were Israel was to count that. That's in Leviticus chapter 25 and 26. Okay. Anyway, he says there will be 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. Well, the 7 weeks, seven periods of 7 years is 49 years. And that's the exact amount of time. It was in the 50th year of the counting from Cyrus that the temple was completed and that the Jerusalem was completely restored. Okay, and then there could be worship of God in Jerusalem the way it used to be. Okay, it took that long to get the temple and Jerusalem and the walls and everything completely restored from the prophecy and from the decree that Cyrus gave to restore it. Okay, Cyrus's decree took that long to be fulfilled, 49 years. And so then he says, and after that, 62 more weeks. Well, 62 more weeks. You do the math, it comes out to the time of Christ. And if you do the chronology correctly, and believe me, there's a lot of wrong chronology, but we'll get into that another time. All right, so it comes to the time of Christ. And then he says, and after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And this is Christ, of course, his crucifixion. And not for himself, that means not because of his own sins, but he is atoning for the sins of the people. And then he says, and the people of the prince who is to come, that there is another prince who is to come, and that prince there is talking about Titus, the Roman general, Titus, and his destruction of Jerusalem the second time. He says, and... where was I? Okay. And the people of the prince who is to come, that is the people of this prince, this future prince, who's Titus, and his people are the Romans, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So it's what's interesting about this is Daniel is prophesying this while the temple is in destruction because of Nebuchadnezzar. He's prophesying this just before Cyrus defeated the Babylonians and then allowed the Jews to go back. His prophecy includes the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple. And then there's another prince in the future who's going to arise, and he's going to destroy the temple that is being rebuilt by the Jews after, you know, according to Cyrus's decree. And this is the Romans. And he says, so the city and the sanctuary and the end of it will be with a flood. And that's the war that took place in AD 70 when the Romans completely destroyed Jerusalem. And until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now, between verse 26 and verse 27, it skips all the way to the end times. And I'm not going to get into verse 27 right now, okay? But that last period of 7 years is in the end times. And he has, Daniel has divided this 70-week period up into three sections. The first is 7 weeks, that is 49 years. Then there is a period of 62 weeks of years, and then there is a period of 7 years. And so there is a gap between the last two periods there that Daniel identifies, okay? That is the age in which we're living. And we're actually given how long that duration is. But I'm not going to get into that now. Okay, that's when we get into chronology, we'll talk about that. All right. Now, so what I want you to see is that there is a clear prediction about the restoration of the temple under Cyrus after the end of the first exile, followed by a future prince and his people who are going to utterly destroy Jerusalem a second time. So we have a second destruction of Jerusalem, followed by a second exile. Now, I want you to flip over to Luke chapter 21, and Jesus references this, and he's no doubt borrowing from Daniel's prophecy. In Luke chapter 21, he talks about the second destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, which was, he prophesied this only 40 years before it occurred. Okay, it's interesting, you got that 40-year period of Jesus prophesied it before, 40 years before it occurred. Jeremiah prophesied the first destruction beginning 40 years before it occurred. Okay, that's pretty interesting, I think. But anyway, in Luke chapter 21, look what it says here. Beginning in verse 20, he says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." He uses the same term that's used of the first destruction and the following exile, the desolation of Jerusalem. Because as long as there is no temple in Jerusalem, it is desolate. Okay, I want you to know that. You can know that for certain that we are still in the second exile, regardless of the fact that there are some Jews in the land and that there's an Israeli government in the land. God still considers Jerusalem desolate because there's no temple. Okay, it's when God restores the temple that we'll know that the exile is over. All right. So he says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies," again, Jesus saying this to his disciples, "then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let those who are in the country enter her. For these are days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant," and so forth. Let's skip down to verse 24. "They will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive into all nations, and Jerusalem," now this is the exile, "Jerusalem shall be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." So there's a period of time called the times of the Gentiles when God is allowing, he has put Israel into exile. It's still the law of Moses, the curse of the law of Moses is still upon them, but he's put them into exile as a nation, and now the gospel is open to all the nations. Okay, all right. So there's an end to that second exile, which Jesus mentioned here. Now, I told you that there are many other Old Testament passages that prophesy of the second exile of Israel and the second destruction of Jerusalem. So if you got your pen handy, here are some of them. All right, Isaiah chapter 28, verses 1 through 18. And Isaiah 29, 1 through 15. Now these are the two consecutive chapters. All right, but it, again, in those two chapters, in those two sections I just gave you, it gives Israel's, why Israel's going to be destroyed, because he calls them the drunkards of Ephraim, because their leaders are, they have no sense, okay? They have no reasoning. They have, anyway. He's talking about Israel at the time of Christ. And then he goes on in chapter, he tells them that their plot with Rome is going to come back and bite them. And then he said, which was to crucify Christ. And then he goes on to talk about Jerusalem's destruction. Again, in chapter 29, he calls it Ariel, the city of God. All right, now, another passage is Isaiah 50, 1 through 11. Isaiah 51, 13 through 23. Hosea 2, 2 through 12. All right, and again, those are just a few passages that prophesy the second destruction of Jerusalem. And in I think one or two of those in Isaiah talks about him restoring them the second time after the end of the second exile. Now, this leaves us with one little conundrum. And that conundrum is the fact that while it's very clear that in Revelation 17 and 18, the prophecy is first of all, this woman riding the beast is identified as Babylon. So, I mean, that's pretty clear. but it's also called Mystery Babylon. So why is it called Mystery Babylon? It's because it parallels ancient Babylon, God's battle axe. Okay. And by the way, I wanted to show you that before I finish. Hang on, just one second. In Jeremiah 51, he actually refers to Babylon as God's battle axe. Let me see if I can find that real quick. Actually, you know what? It's in there. You find it. All right, when you're reading through those two chapters. All right. It's towards the end of the chapter. All right. Now, but the point is the one element of the symbolism that's used in Revelation 17 and 18 to refer to Mystery Babylon, the one element that we haven't really dealt with regarding Babylon is, why is Mystery Babylon referred to as fornicating and a prostitute and an adulteress? And those terms and that imagery usually in the Old Testament refers to Jerusalem. It refers to God's people. Now, how is Babylon God's people? And why is ancient Babylon was not God's people? Well, the reason for that is because Mystery Babylon, again, is prophesying about the future from John's day, from John's perspective. In John's day, Rome was persecuting Christians. John was on the island of Patmos, a prison island of Patmos, because the Romans had sent him there because they were persecuting the Christians under the reign of the Emperor Domitian at that time. All right? They're persecuting Christians. Well, what Revelation 17 and 18, what it does is in a very cryptic way, it prophesies the future of Rome from John's perspective. And the future of Rome, what happened with Rome, the city of Rome? Well, we know that Christians were persecuted by the Romans, and so they were on the outs with the Romans from the time of Christ all the way up until the time of the Emperor Constantine in AD 325. But in AD 325, what we see is Constantine, the Emperor of Rome, supposedly was converted to Christianity, even though he continued to worship his pagan idols. And what he did is he then used Christianity, which had become very large and prominent in the Roman Empire, he used Christianity to merge with the government so that the government, the emperor, actually took over control of the Roman church and, by extension, all the other churches. Because by the time of Constantine, the church in Rome was probably the largest church because it was the largest city. All right, Rome was the capital of the empire, and because it was the largest city, the church, they had more Christians part of the church in Rome, or the assembly in Rome. And so, because it was the largest assembly, and because there were no more apostles to appeal to, the other assemblies began to look to Rome for guidance. And this was a gradual thing of Rome becoming prominent. But it became prominent because it was in the capital city. And what Constantine the emperor did is he sort of absorbed, became a Christian, and then wanted to make Christianity on an equal footing with the pagan religions. And also he wanted to be sort of benevolent, especially to Christianity. Well, what he did is he got the bishops of all the different major cities, the Christian bishops or pastors of all these major cities, because he put an end to the official persecution of Christianity and outlawed the persecution of Christianity and elevated Christianity within his empire, claiming himself to be a Christian, that what he did is he gained the trust of the Christian assemblies in the empire. And by doing that, he then inserted himself and began to sort of twist the arms of all the bishops in order to get them to do what he wanted, because he wanted to use Christianity as a political tool to unify his empire. And so this is the beginning of what we call Roman Catholicism, that we see this sort of, instead of Christianity being a bunch of local assemblies that are independent of each other but in fellowship with one another, what we see now is the beginning of a top-down sort of enforcing of the will of the Bishop of Rome, who then is in bed with the emperor, down upon the other assemblies. And so what Constantine did, the way he sort of hoodwinked the Christian pastors, he called this big council of Christian pastors from all over the empire, and it's called the Council of Nicaea. And this was to supposedly settle the disputes that were going on about different versions of the Godhead, primarily between the Arians and the Trinitarian, the proto-Trinitarians, I guess we should call them. And so he called all these together, and they hashed out all this stuff. And Constantine didn't care which view won. In fact, he sided kind of with the Arians at the beginning. But his point was, what he really wanted to do was to exercise his controls gradually over this whole body of pastors and bishops. So by doing that, he twisted their arms, and because he is the guy who stopped the persecution of Christianity, these pastors were eager to please the emperor, all right? And so they developed the Nicene Creed eventually to establish one of these viewpoints of the Godhead as being the official Christian doctrine of God, which was leaning heavily towards Trinitarianism at that time. Trinitarianism wasn't fully developed until later, but it was leaning heavily in that direction, all right? So anyway, what we see then is the merging of Christianity. It's radical change, and it happened when persecution stopped. And there was a merging between Christianity and the political power, the Roman Empire. They merged together. And that from that point on, the Bishop of Rome, the Roman Assembly, was pretty much the puppet of the emperor. And he called the shots. And he allowed them to make theological decisions and things like that, but he twisted their arms to get them to make the decisions he wanted to kind of. And one of the big things he did, which is another topic for another day, but he was heavily involved in Greek philosophy, and he imposed his Greek philosophical, particularly Platonism. He imposed that at the Council of Nicaea, and you can read about that in Eusebius's books, who wrote church history. Okay, in about that time, he was alive at that time. All right. Anyway. Don't want to get too far off into that, but my point is that what happened when Rome, the political entity that God used as his battle axe against Jerusalem, that political entity merged with Christianity and became very anti-Semitic. And from the Catholic Church has been anti-Semitic all down through its history. And they have continued to persecute God's people that are in exile, and while they ruled over them as well. Okay, so this merging of the one who destroyed Jerusalem along with the one who has Israel in exile and continues to maintain power over Israel in exile, it was Rome. But it particularly became religious Rome, that is Roman Catholicism, that continued the exile, and it's all about Rome. And so because they took Christianity, Christianity itself became corrupt, and they're indistinguishable. The old Roman Empire and Roman Catholicism became indistinguishable. And you know, where is the Vatican right now? It's right there in Rome, right? It's in the city of Rome. It's what's left of the Roman Empire. Rome, as a so-called religious institution, is exerting the power, the political power. Why does Roman Catholicism have so much political power? They've got embassies in all these different countries. Why do they have so much political power? Because they're the continuation of ancient Rome, the Rome that persecuted the apostles. And because the Christianity of Rome adopted so much of the paganism of Constantine and the other emperors that came after it, so much Greek philosophy, and have merged all that in with Christianity, and have really changed pristine Christianity to be a mixture of the teachings of Christ and the apostles, mixed in with Greek philosophy and paganism. You know, you got prayers to the saints and all that. You've got necromancy. Prayers to the saints is necromancy, which God forbid. Okay, the dead are dead. They're not alive, floating around somewhere that you can pray to them. But they've got the images. They've got necromancy. They've got all this stuff that's adopted from paganism. They've got purgatory and all this immortality of the soul and all that stuff that is adopted from Plato, from Greek philosophy. It's all mixed in together. Now, this is the reason why Mystery Babylon, which is Rome, is referred to as being a prostitute, as referred to as committing fornication with all the kings of the earth. So all the fornication aspect of this is, it's very much like what God said about Jerusalem in ancient times, but it's not Jerusalem. It's the same kind of thing with regard to Christianity. Now Christianity has become the harlot. Christianity in Rome has become the prostitute that God is going to utterly destroy. Okay, he's going to destroy Rome, as we will see in future lessons. Now, just to show you that, you know, in the Old Testament, God uses prostitution, fornication, adultery, those things. He uses those as a metaphor for his own covenant people being mixed up in idolatry and the idolatry of the pagan nations, all right, and their thinking and their philosophies. He uses that. But in the New Testament, he uses the exact same terminology with regard to Christians being mixed up with paganism, being mixed up with Greek philosophy. Now, that's something that may come as a surprise to people, but it's absolutely true. And I want to just show you that very briefly. First of all, I'm not going to go there because I'm really out of time. I've gone quite a bit over time already. But in James 4:4, just look up James 4:4, where James writes to the churches, the assemblies, and he calls them adulterers and adulteresses. And he says, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? And that is this kinship with the philosophies of the world, the idolatry of the world, the wickedness of the world, all that is considered by God as fornication, as prostitution, okay, as adultery. Now, I want you to look at just one passage, and then we're going to be done. Go to 2 Corinthians, chapter 11. And I want you to notice, Paul uses the same kind of imagery and terminology with regard to Christianity. He borrows, you know, in the Old Testament, God's covenant people, Israel, it says he was married to them, right? It's the son who was married to them, who carried them through out of Egypt and into the promised land. And it's the Son of God who did all those things. The Bible's clear about that in the New Testament. But anyway, it talks about this marriage covenant that he had, and then how he divorced them when he sent them into exile, in the first exile, all right? And he's going to gather them again. Well, he's divorced them again. But now there's a remnant. And us Gentiles have been united with that remnant of Israel in one body. In fact, Paul says that in Ephesians chapter 2 that he has created from the two one new man. And that new man is the all believers as a single entity. He looks at all believers as being part of Christ himself. Okay, and so when we get to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, look at what he says here in verse 1. He says, "Oh, that you would bear with me a little folly, and indeed you do bear with me. For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband. that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. Again, he's using the imagery that's in Revelation. And what's the imagery in Revelation? The imagery is that the redeemed in the end are to be the bride of the Lamb, that is the Son, right? And so, but look what he says about them. Oh, sorry about that. He says, but I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which we have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. Now, what is he saying? Well, he's talking about Gnosticism. Gnosticism, or by that time it was what we would call proto-Gnosticism. Gnosticism was just forming. But it twisted who Christ was. It twisted the meaning of the gospel. It twisted the destiny of the righteous. Instead of being the land that God promised to Abraham and to his seed, and we are his seed, it twisted that. It took Plato's vision of heaven as being the destiny. It accepted Plato's doctrine of immortality of the soul and some of these other things. All right. So he's calling these things another gospel because they have another hope, a different hope. But look what he says. What he does is he portrays the Corinthians assembly as being part of that bride that he has espoused to Christ, whom when the exile is over and God and his Son comes and the bride is restored and he marries her again in the end, okay, at the time of the kingdom, which includes the remnant of Israel, but it also includes us Gentiles, that he says, he says, I'm jealous over you with a godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband that I may present to you as a chaste virgin. But he says, I fear lest somehow the serpent deceived Eve with his craftiness, your minds are going to be corrupted. Now, the corruption means that the bride has dirty garments. The bride is not pure. She's not a pure virgin. And you see this theme all through Revelation when the redeemed are to be presented to Christ as a pure virgin wearing white robes and not defiled robes. We talked a lot about this in the seven letters to the seven assembly, where he talked about some in the assemblies who had defiled their garments, and then he talked about those dressed in white who are going to have an inheritance in the kingdom. All right, you can see this theme is used repeatedly. So my point is simply this, that this idea of prostitution and fornication and not being a chaste virgin, that is a pure virgin, which is what the prostitution and fornication is, that is the theme of Mystery Babylon, that she's a prostitute. She has gone full in with the corruption of the world and the world's philosophies, okay? And so that's why in Revelation, Mystery Babylon is seen to be a prostitute. He's not talking about Jerusalem. He's talking about Rome. It's very clear he's talking about Rome, all right? Rome is the battle axe that God used to destroy Jerusalem and send them into exile. Rome then merged with Christianity and became a prostitute, taking the name of Christ but prostituting everything, all right? And then she is the one who's going to be destroyed. Now, next time, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to get right into the text of chapter 17, and we're going to go through chapter 17. And there's a lot to unpack in chapter 17. But all this that I've given you in the last two lessons is really critical so that you have a proper understanding of how to handle the symbols and a proper understanding of who Mystery Babylon is and the historical context for all these things. All right? It's been a pleasure being with you, and we'll see you next time.